So our next speaker is Dr. Janice Carignali. You met Janice last night. Janice is a family medicine physician at Tenwick Mission Hospital. She's been there with her husband, Dino, since 2008. They had previously done some short-term work in both the Dominican Republic and Nepal before heading to Tenwick. She's going to be speaking to us on cholera and tetanus.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. And first, can everyone hear me? Sometimes I get complaints that I don't speak loud enough, except for my children, and they always hear me because I'm yelling. But can everyone hear me? It's okay. Okay. So today I'm here to talk about tetanus and cholera, alive and well in the developing world, unfortunately. But they really are. And as I was thinking about this lecture this morning, I thought, you know, oftentimes doctors will put up their disclosures at the beginning. And do I have any disclosures about, do I own tetanus vaccine stock? And my only disclosure that I could think of was that I am truly not an expert in either of these diseases. And I thought, I'm not sure if they want to hear that, but they're going to. And as I thought about giving a lecture to people who are perhaps more experienced in even these particular diseases, you know, that kind of, those feelings of, well, I'm not an expert, and what skills do I bring, those thoughts begin to come. And as I was thinking about that, I thought probably the most important thing I could do today during this lecture time is to share that with you. Because as a group of doctors who are thinking about or have experienced either short or long-term missions, those feelings of what skills do I have? Am I prepared well enough? Am I going to be able to do the things that I need to do? Those thoughts definitely will come to us. And God has really worked in my heart over the past 8 years that we've been at Tenwick to say it is not about your skills. It is not about your expertise or lack thereof. It is about your being obedient and coming if I've called you. And I just want to encourage any of you who are maybe thinking, well, is my skill set? Is it right for where I need to go? Or will I have enough knowledge base to do the things that God's called me to do? I'd like to just encourage you that the times where we fall short are the times that we get to experience God's miraculous work in our patients' lives. And so I just really want to encourage you about that. Now, hopefully today we will learn something about tetanus and we will learn something about cholera. But don't rely on your own skills and don't depend on your own skills. Just really depend on God's work in your patients' lives, and then you'll be fine. Okay. So today I'm going to start by talking about tetanus, which is a disease that we definitely still see. And the real question is, why do we care? I practiced for 8 or 9 years in the U.S. before I went to Kenya, never saw a case of tetanus, never heard anyone have a case of tetanus in our area or in any of the hospitals around, just never really thought much about it other than the fact that you need your tetanus shot when you come for your physical exam. And that was about it. However, the mortality of tetanus is really quite high, and you'll see 20 to 90%. It's quite a large variation. And the reason is it depends where the case is and who gets it. If you're in a country with access to modern medical care, your mortality may be about 20% if you're a healthy adult to begin with. In the developing world, it's about 50%. And if you're a child or an elderly person, it can approach up to 80 to 90%. In 1988, 787,000 newborns died of tetanus. That is unbelievable to me. That is a huge statistic. Especially considering that it is an easily preventable disease. So WHO got a hold of that statistic and they said, this is unacceptable, what can we do about it? And they came up with WHO elimination guidelines, elimination being less than one case per 1,000 live births for neonatal tetanus. So from 1999 to 2011, 113 million women were vaccinated with two doses of the vaccine. And indeed, it made a big difference. In 2013, only 40,000 infants died. Now, I say only 40,000 is still a huge number. So we're still working on it. 21 countries still are left that have not met this WHO elimination goal, which was actually scheduled for 2015. So they've now rescheduled it. And unfortunately, one of the countries I was surprised and sad to hear continues to be Kenya, where we live and practice. So currently, there's an estimated 1 million cases a year with approximately 500,000 deaths, including adults and children. In contrast, in the United States, there's only 233 cases over the years 2001 to 2008. So it really is a disease that we know how to take care of, we know how to prevent, and we just need to continue working towards it. So what is tetanus? Pathophysiology. Tetanus is caused by Clostridium tetani. It's a gram-positive organism. The spores are widespread. They are out there. I had patients here in the U.S. say, well, I don't really need a tetanus shot. I can't really get tetanus. And I said, well, yes, indeed you do, because the spores are out there. And the reason you haven't gotten it is because you've had immunity provided by your vaccination. The reservoir is in animal and human feces. And the pathophysiology of the disease, you have a wound, typically a deep wound, and the spores enter the wound and they begin to germinate. The reason that it has to be a deep wound is because it's an obligate anaerobe, so it has to be grow outside the presence of oxygen. In addition, it really enjoys if there's tissue that is necrotic. It really enjoys that, which is why puncture wounds that are deep fit both of those criteria. However, about 50% of wounds that cause the disease of tetanus are considered minor wounds. And depending on the statistics that you look at, many people will not know or not be able to identify a previous injury before they come in with a disease of tetanus. The spores are very hardy. Just so you know, they can survive autoclave at 250 degrees for up to 10 to 15 minutes, and they can also survive many antiseptics. So washout, when Dan talks about orthopedic injuries, washout is extremely important. So once the spores get in and germinate, what happens next is there's a toxin that's produced. It's called tetanospasm. It's extremely potent. It's one of the most potent poisons known to man. And 175 billionths of a gram can be fatal for a 70-kilogram adult. The other thing that's really important to recognize is that the binding is irreversible. Once this toxin is in there, there's nothing you can do to get the toxin to unbind from the receptors. So that makes a big difference as we're thinking about treatment and what to do once someone has the actual disease. Initial signs and symptoms, in general, most tetanus that you'll see in these developing nations will be generalized tetanus. We call it lockjaw for a reason because of the masseter muscle spasms, and about 50 to 75% of people will actually come in with that classic presentation. But there are other presentations as well. Generalized muscle stiffness, abdominal muscle rigidity, are also common presentations. You can have localized tetanus with localized symptoms, or even cephalic tetanus, where you'll have cranial nerve palsies as an initial symptom. These other diseases, including the localized and the cephalic, they often present localized, but they do often continue on to be generalized. Symptoms often begin about 10 days after the wound and after the spores are introduced, but the range can be 3 to 21 days. I already mentioned localized tetanus. Neonatal tetanus, obviously, is still a huge problem in the developing world. These patients tend to present with irritability and poor feeding. They progress to rigidity with spasms, and the incubation period tends to be on the lower end, more like the 3 to 5 to 7 days with neonatal tetanus. And this is a picture of a baby. You can see, I mean, the baby looks rigid. It's not too difficult to tell that that baby is not a floppy baby, but a rigid baby, and you have to deal with that and take that seriously. So the motor effects of the toxin, people will have trismus, and they have this facial grimace called sardonicus. And it's the best way to describe it is probably to show you the picture of it, where you can see the teeth. It's almost like it's a grimace or a smile. The eyebrows tend to be raised along with that. Other issues with the motor symptoms, that people can have difficulty in breathing because of chest wall muscle spasms, abdominal muscle wall spasms. They can actually get fracture of the long bones just from the disease itself, from the muscle spasms and the severity of that. And they can get laryngospasm, which leads to hypoxia. Now, one of the things we think about with tetanus, oftentimes we just think about the motor symptoms of the disease. And we fail to recognize the incredible autonomic effects of the disease as well. Now, when this neurotoxin, when this toxin binds to the motor end plates, it binds, as I said, it binds irreversibly. And the way it works is it actually inhibits the inhibitory effect of neurotransmitters. So what you have is you have excitation that cannot be inhibited. And so you have these motor neurons that are just excited, but it does the same to the autonomic system as well. And there's still ongoing study on this, but what we know is that you can find 100-fold adrenaline concentrations in the blood. And you can imagine that causes problems. But it's not always what you would expect. You can have hypertension, extreme, or you can have hypotension. You can have tachycardia, or you might have bradycardia. You can have pyrexia, sweating, urinary retention. So what do you do when you see a patient like this? So at Tenwick, we had a 10-year-old boy come in who was obviously in extreme pain, extreme muscle spasms, classic facial expression. He was a little bit hypoxic. And what do you do? I mean, you know that the disease is irreversible. You know that the mortality rate is high. So what do you do for these people? And if you think about it, if you try to classify it, it makes it much easier to figure out how to treat the person. The first thing that's important is to go ahead and halt toxin production. If they have an active infection and they are continuing to make more toxin, you need to stop that from happening. So you need to search for the wound and find out if there's still a wound present, and if so, you need to go ahead and debride it, and you need to clean it. This works best, obviously, in prevention, but even for treatment, if they have an active wound, if you don't get in there and debride it, you're just going to be behind the game the whole time. I don't know about any of you who have practiced overseas, but history is very difficult where we are. I always say if you take a history once, take it a second time, and by the fourth time, maybe you'll have an idea of what actually happened, because at least where we are, patients tell you different things each time. Still haven't exactly figured out, but someone might come in and say, yesterday I fell, and then you see that they're, limb looks necrotic, and it looks like it's been like that for months. Maybe it was a few months ago. And it's hard to know exactly why the history is difficult, but look for, and don't take their word for it, look for any wounds. Antibiotics are important, but they are much less helpful than actually debriding and cleaning the wounds. So metronidazole is the medication of choice, but you can go ahead and use penicillin as well. And again, the treatment does not seem to be based on antibiotics alone, certainly. So after you halt new toxin production, you need to take out any unbound toxin that you can to, again, prevent more binding to these receptors. So tetanus immunoglobulin is really the mainstay of neutralizing this unbound toxin. Dosing, again, it looks like it's a large variation between 500 to 6,000 units IM. And the reason is, originally, there were studies that were based on 3,000 to 6,000 units, but it has been shown more recently that 500 units seems to be equally as effective, although the studies are not very large. So you need to give them tetanus immunoglobulin. If you don't have it, you can use equine antitoxin. That's okay. Make sure you test them for hypersensitivity first. The other thing that tends to be forgotten is that you cannot forget that even though someone survives tetanus, has tetanus, they are not immune to tetanus because the amount of toxin in their system is so small that it actually will not confer immunity for future. So we do recommend tetanus vaccination at the same time as tetanus immunoglobulin. Now, don't give it in the same syringe. Don't give it in the same arm, two different arms, but give them both at the same time. People will also say, do you give the tetanus immunoglobulin around the area of the wound? And the answer seems to be no, that it does not make a difference. You can just go ahead and give it IM in an extremity, and that's fine. So now we've halted the production. We've taken care of any unbound toxin, but now you still have this young boy who's in front of you, and he is miserable. The downside of tetanus is that it doesn't affect mental state, and so people are very much aware of the pain and suffering that they're going through at the time. So we need to do something about that. So the first thing to do is to control muscle spasms. Benzodiazepines are your friend, very, very much so. And you need to give a lot of this stuff. I mean, it just takes a lot to try to control this. Mag sulfate is another very good alternative. And for those of you who say, yeah, I've never used that, talk to your OB friends. They will really help guide you. But it's very simple to do. You give a bolus, and then you run it, and then you just follow patellar reflexes. It's not a difficult thing to do. It's just sometimes for medical patients, it might be the first time for you to try it, but it's definitely well worth it because not only does it control the muscle spasms, it also controls the autonomic symptoms as well. Neuromuscular blockers are an option, and we're going to talk about airway management later in a few minutes, and I'll talk about that more then, but you would need to obviously have that available for you. Managing the autonomic symptoms, again, mag sulfate is probably your drug of choice. Morphine is very helpful as well. You can use atropine for secretions. Now, beta blockers, the reason that they've kind of gone away from beta blockers is because of the risk of sudden death with this, with the autonomic instability. So really, although there's some conflicting evidence out there, it's probably best to avoid it. And Clondine as well has conflicting reports. So airway management. So when you're sitting with this patient in front of you who was previously healthy and who is now suffering terribly, the question is, what do you do? Well, here in the U.S., it's an easy answer. You bring them to the ICU, you put them on a vent, you make them comfortable, you take care of them, and 4 to 6 weeks later, they get off the vent, and they hopefully go home. In the developing world, it's much more complicated. And honestly, it's even more complicated when you work in a setting that has some resources, but not great. Because, for example, when Dino and I first arrived at Tenwick, I think we had 3 working vents, sometimes 4, sometimes 2, depending on which ones we're working at the time. And if you were to consider putting a patient with that you knew was going to need vent management for 2 to 3 to 4 weeks, what would you do with the next person that came in? And when you said, oh, well, I need that for because you're a poisoning overdose and you need 24-hour vent management and I don't have one. What about another case that you said, well, 24 hours on the vent would surely take care of this, but what do you do? And these are real difficult things that you have to deal with when you're in a resource-poor setting. And I'd encourage any of you, either who have been on or going on short-term missions, to talk to the long-term doctors that are there, not because they have the answers, but because they have a different perspective. And for long-term, those of us that are there, we talk to the long-term doctors as well. We talk together and we try to come up with a management plan that makes the most sense. In general, our rule of thumb is if we don't think you'll successfully make it off a ventilator within 72 hours, we probably won't go ahead and try one for you because what it would mean for the hospital, for the other patients, and also because we're not good at taking care of long-term vent management patients in our setting. It's just a difficult thing to do. So decide when the patient arrives what your plan will be if they need airway management, because you don't want to be 3 o'clock in the morning trying to figure out, do I have a vent? Will I use it? What do I do about it? Prevention, obviously, because it's always best to prevent. We really need to pay attention to whether or not our patients, both here and in the developing world, are immunized against the disease. Here in the U.S., we actually do very well. There were only 15 cases of childhood tetanus from 1992 to 2000. In 12 of these cases, 80% of them were due to parental refusal for vaccine. I don't know how many of you are experiencing that or have experienced that here with people saying, I don't want the vaccines, but we need to encourage and convince our patients that these diseases are real. And if you don't have your children immunized, it's quite possible that they may come up against something that we could have prevented. Although we do a good job in children, we do not do a very good job in people over the age of 60. Especially for tetanus, we do not give our boosters regularly enough, and we need to be reminded that tetanus booster for people every 10 years is recommended and important. In the U.S., 40% of people over 60 lack immunity to tetanus. For primary prevention, you need 3 doses in infancy, a booster at age 4 to 6, again at age 12 to 15, and every 10 years. Now, and for adults in developing world who have never been immunized, it should be, hopefully, a 3-dose series. You give one, the second one 2 months later, and the third one at 6 to 12 months. And so we should be trying to start and document even patients who come in for a cough or a cold or anything. We should be trying to remember to say, do you have your immunization book from when you were a child? And if they don't, we should be recommending that these people are getting their tetanus vaccinations. So what happens when someone comes in and they have an exposure? They come into casualty for a minor cut. It was clean, not a big deal. What do you do with these people, and when do you recommend tetanus prophylaxis? So if they've been previously immunized and have had their primary series, if it's a contaminated wound, if it's been more than 5 years, then you go ahead and give another tetanus booster. If it's a clean wound, you can wait until the full 10 years. The question about if they've not had a previous primary series, which is considered 3 doses, what do you do? And I think I actually have a... I'm not sure if you can see that. Can you read that? Possibly not. But again, if you look, this should be in your handout. If it's less than 3 doses and it's a clean minor wound, go ahead and give a tetanus shot, but you don't need to worry about tetanus immunoglobulin. But all other wounds, anything that's deep, anything that's contaminated, anything that has tissue necrosis, everything else, you need to give both tetanus vaccination and tetanus immunoglobulin as prevention for tetanus. Dosing is quite simple, 250 units IM for prevention, and it goes a long way to making a difference in preventing these people coming in a month later, a few weeks later, with the disease. So please think about tetanus in your settings. Think about it here in the U.S., but also overseas, and we need to try to remember that prevention is the best medicine. Okay, I'm going to switch gears for a minute and talk about cholera, which is another disease that we see in the developing world. Originally, cholera was in the Ganges Delta in India. But since 1817, it's made its debut in the rest of the world, and it's really come out strong. We are now in our 7th pandemic in the world, and I think most of us were familiar with a Haiti outbreak fairly recently as well. WHO estimates 3 to 5 million cases per year, and there are approximately 100,000 deaths yearly from this diarrheal disease. Treatable disease. We can't forget that diarrheal diseases are the second leading cause of mortality worldwide in children over the age of 5. So pathophysiology, the disease is caused by Vibrio cholera. It's primarily a disease caused by ingestion of contaminated food or water. Person-to-person transmission is rare. And in fact, when we talk about prevention from transmission, we do not recommend household treatment with antibiotics for household contacts of people with a case, because person-to-person transmission is rare. In general, cholera survives in the presence of salt, so it's very interesting to me, if you look at the outbreaks in general, they're in coastal countries. It can survive in warm climates. That doesn't, in a not salty environment, but in general, it certainly prefers salty environments. Again, the pathogenesis, it's pretty straightforward. I think we probably all are aware of some of this, but let's just review it quickly. So first, you ingest the organisms. Of note, people who are taking anti-acid medication like H2 blockers, those people are at increased risk because the majority of organisms that we ingest are killed by the stomach acid, so that's considered protective. It has a short incubation period from a few hours up to 5 days. And in fact, especially during the Haiti outbreak, it was noted that many of the deaths caused from cholera, the deaths occurred approximately 12 hours after the onset of symptoms. So it's severe and it's fast. And that's the biggest challenge that we have as healthcare providers, is to get the resources to these people when the outbreak begins. So it colonizes the small intestine. It does not invade, but it colonizes in the lumen. And this enterotoxin is produced. Increased CAMP, decreased sodium absorption, increased secretion of sodium and water. So classically, right, these are the people that come in with severe watery diarrhea associated with vomiting. Severe liters of fluid in the bucket. However, not all cholera is classic. In fact, 75% of people who are infected never develop any symptoms at all, but they'll shed virus for up to 14 days. 80 to 90% of people that do have symptoms, it's very mild. They can't differentiate it from any other diarrheal illness. They never seek care, and they just go on their way. However, it is the less than 5% of people who are infected that develop severe diarrhea. And these people can put out up to 1 liter of diarrheal fluid an hour. That's a lot of diarrhea. In general, these people, when you're trying to differentiate them from other causes of diarrhea, they don't have a lot of abdominal pain or tenesmus. They will occasionally, because of the fluid inside the intestine, they will occasionally complain of cramping, but pain does not seem to be a primary component of their complaints. Their fever is absent. And the diarrhea is very classic. It looks like water. And in fact, that's diarrheal diarrhea in the tube. They call it rice water stools. Now, don't be fooled. When someone comes in and is in the very initial part of their illness, they will have fecal, brown, watery diarrhea. Because, again, just like a colonoscopy clean out, at first you have to get what's in there out. And then this is the secretion that comes out after that. Complications, again, this is not rocket science. This goes back to like medical school. Dehydration, electrolyte imbalance. Don't forget hypoglycemia as a cause, especially if your patient comes in and is lethargic. And again, the treatment is pretty straightforward as well. Fluids, fluids, fluids. And the biggest mistake we as healthcare providers make is not giving enough fluids and not giving them fast enough. So you have to get on top of this. If you give rapid high-volume fluid replacement, it definitely has been shown to save lives. It brings the mortality down from over 50% down to less than 0.2%. We can make a huge difference if we really are able to not only ourselves, but within our facilities and the outlying facilities we deal with, if we're able to really encourage education both for our patients and our staff. So the first thing you do when you're presented with a patient is you need to classify them as far as their category of dehydration. And again, this is some basic stuff, but important for us to remember. WHO now classifies as either no dehydration, some, or severe. But it's really the same categories as we used to say, mild, moderate to severe, less than 5%, 5 to 10%, or 10% or greater. And again, when you're talking about these categories, remember that if you have someone with mental status changes, you really need to be careful and really aggressively treat them because they are in the severe category. So in general, 80% of people with severe symptoms from cholera can still be treated with ORS alone. And in fact, it's not, oh, well, we only have ORS. It is really truly that ORS is the preferred method of treatment for these patients. If your patient is alert, you can consider an NG tube, although be aware, again, the risk of aspiration in a patient who's not fully alert is a real and serious complication. If they have severe dehydration or uncontrollable vomiting, as I said, you need to go to IV fluids. ORS, most of us will realize that ORS is available, readily available, in many places, but if not, I've just put this in for a reference, you can make, go ahead and make your own. So if a patient has no dehydration, how do you go ahead and treat the diarrhea? Again, we've said you have to be on top of this, and because they can be entering a very severe phase, you have to go ahead and rehydrate them aggressively. At first, you can start, if they don't appear to be dehydrated, you can start and you can give 100 milliliters or so of fluid of ORS by mouth after each episode. But again, remember, you have to be constantly reassessing these patients to find out whether or not they're losing more fluids than you're replacing. For some dehydration, you can assume they're somewhere between 5 and 10% body weight depleted, and so you can average maybe 75 milliliters per kilogram, and you want to give that pretty quickly. And I'm not sure if you're going to be able to read the chart. But again, if you go down on the chart, if there's no hypovolemia, which is the same as less than 5%, you give the ORS after each episode. If there's some, you go ahead and give the ORS and you try to get the 75 over the first 4 hours. And then if there's severe, you actually go ahead and aggressively rehydrate them with 30 mils per kg for the first 30 minutes. And then you go ahead and give the rest of the 100 in the first 4 hours, and then you give another 100. So your goal is 200 mils per kg over 24 hours or more. Occasionally, people will actually put out as much fluid as 100% of their body weight in a 24-hour period. So you just need to keep giving fluids and fluids and fluids and reassess and reassess. It's great if you have the ability to monitor urine output. That's always a wonderful thing, but you may not. And if you don't, the best thing to do is to actually give them a bucket, and if you have cholera cots, they're just cots with a little hole, and you just put the bucket underneath, and they go to the bathroom right there, and you can measure their output, and that will give you a sense. But if they look dehydrated, treat them as if they're dehydrated. The main point about the severe dehydration is if you have LR, you should use it. If you don't have LR, you can use normal saline, but you should also be replacing with ORS at the same time to help with the potassium and the bicarb losses as well. Other treatments, again, just like with tetanus, it's really supportive care. With cholera, it's really fluids, fluids, fluids. Antibiotics can be helpful for severe diarrhea. They are recommended for anyone with moderate to severe, but you don't have to worry. If you have a patient with mild and you're thinking, oh no, what if it's cholera? It's really not a recommended thing to give antibiotics. It doesn't seem to change the course for those people with mild. But for moderate to severe, it decreases the severity, it decreases the duration, and decreases the amount of shedding as well. Zinc is an important adjunct for children, especially, and again, the doses are there. Please remember to avoid anti-motility agents and resume food as soon as possible. Gone are the days where we said, don't feed these kids, stop their breastfeeding. No, please, they should be breastfeeding. Breastfeeding is protective, it's important, and you should breastfeed and give ORS as well. And again, that's a list of antibiotics. You can read through that, but Zithromycin is really the antibiotic of choice at this point. Access to safe drinking water, prevention. This is probably the most important thing, probably the most important slide, especially during a time that we think there may be cholera in our area. You have to really counsel people to safe drinking water. It does not take much to boil water, and it is doable for most people. Most people who are cooking their food, even if only once a day, they already have a fire going. They can put a pot, cover it up, and it'll be fine. And the recommendations now are bring water to a rolling boil, and you can take it right off the heat. It doesn't have to stay on the heat for longer than that. Just once it's at a rolling boil, take it off the heat, cover it. If you're at altitude greater than 6,500 feet, 3 minutes is the recommendation. You don't need to do 10 or 20 or 30 minutes of boiling the water. It's just not necessary. Promote breastfeeding, good hand washing, food prep and cooking, and vaccination. The interesting thing is with vaccination up and coming that we might be seeing is there may be some recommendations coming out for more widespread vaccination for countries with epidemics or endemics. The thought is if we vaccinate 50% of the population, we will decrease the disease burden by 90%. And the reason for that is what's prompting people to say we really need to start considering vaccination for these countries. Another interesting fact is if you don't have any ability to boil your water, simply a sari cloth, so an Indian sari, just pour your water through that, and that decreases the colonization of Vibrio cholerae in the water by 50%. So even if nothing else, they can do simple things like that. And the reason for that is because the zooplankton, the algae that it's associated with, can be filtered out pretty easily. So that's definitely worthwhile doing. In Kenya at Tenwick, when we had a small outbreak of this in this past year, it was very, very helpful to also get the government officials involved. If there's a health officer in your area, get them involved, and they can really step up and do the prevention piece as well within the community. So I hope that we've covered a little bit. My time is up. I hope that we've covered a little bit about the basics. I hope that you feel more comfortable when you come across tetanus and cholera. And hopefully you'll just remember, again, whether it's here or overseas, that relying on our skills and our skill set is not always the best, but really turning to God to ask for his help in whatever situation we face, that's where we're going to see the most exciting results from our work. So thank you.
Thank you very much. We will go ahead and take a break and start back up at 3:45. Thank you.